Things over to you to kick off the session.
Great, thanks, Jean. So good afternoon and welcome everyone to today's internet webinar, or seminar. This is Integrating Data from Multidisciplinary Research, Session 1, Introducing the Big Picture webinar. This webinar is sponsored by the National Institutes of Environmental Health Sciences Superfund Research Program, and my name is Michelle Heacock. I'm a health scientist administrator in the Division of Extramural Research and Training, Hazardous Substance Research Branch, Superfund Research Program. I'll be moderating the session. We'll get started in a few moments. While we wait for others to log on, I'd like to cover a few housekeeping items. When you've registered, you're directed to the seminar's specific URL, which is the front page of today's webinar. The front page of the webcast contains a short abstract of today's session. We've also included pictures and short bio sketches of the presenters. Please note that the presenters' email addresses are hot-linked on that page in case you have any questions for them after today's presentation. Those of you joining us via the limited number of phone lines, your phone lines were automatically put on mute when you joined the call, as Jean was saying earlier. We request that you keep your phone on mute for the seminar. We've allotted time for questions and answers, at which point you are welcome to take your phone off mute and ask the question by pressing star 6 to unmute your phone. After asking your question, please put your phone back on mute by pressing star 6 again. I stand corrected. Take your phone off mute by pressing pound 6, and then put your phone back on mute by pressing star 6. Again, that's pound 6 to unmute and star 6 to mute. This will greatly reduce background noises that can disrupt the quality of the audio transmission. Also, please don't put us on hold, because many organizations have hold music or advertisements that can be very disruptive to the call. Again, please keep us on mute and don't put us on hold. So by now, all of you should have joined into the Adobe Connect meeting room and should see a number of windows or pods within the room, which include the presentation materials. The introductory presentation should be visible. Okay. If you have any problems viewing the slides or shared content, you may click the full screen button in the upper right corner of the shared slide window to expand that content. To shrink it back down to normal size, just simply press full screen again. If you experience other technical issues with Adobe Connect, you may be able to download a portion of the items that will be covered and follow along manually. But please note, we cannot confirm that all the portions of a seminar will be available in this manner. The majority of our participants will be listening to the presentation online, presentation audio online through Adobe Connect. If you have any problems with the audio, please check your own PC speakers or headphones. If you're on the phone lines, you may need to turn off your computer speaker or the online audio to eliminate duplicate broadcasts or feedback. You may submit questions by using the Q&A pod you see in the lower right corner. You need not wait until the Q&A periods to submit your questions. In fact, we encourage you to submit them in advance of the Q&A session. Please add to your question who you're directing the question to. Please note, questions will only be visible to the host. Other participants will not be able to view the questions. At the appropriate times for the Q&A, the moderator, that's me, will read the questions out loud to be answered by the presenters. If you experience technical difficulties with the audio stream, you may use the Q&A pod to alert us the technical difficulties you're encountering. Please include a telephone number where we can reach you, and we'll try to troubleshoot your problem again. You may also contact our technical support directly at 301-589-5318. The number again is 309-5318. At the end of the webinar, we will walk you through our related URLs pod, where we have assembled information that is directly applicable to today's topic. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. We typically place these seminars in an archive with the soundtrack. So in the near future, you'll be able to access the slides and hear the presentations as they were given today. You will automatically receive an email once the archive is available. Associated with the related URLs pod is an online seminar feedback form. We will ask that you consider filling out the online seminar feedback form. We do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanisms. You can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. With that, we are ready to start the session. Once more, I'd like to remind phone participants to keep your phones on mute, and again, please don't put us on hold. So now that we've got the technical details out of the way, we can focus on the content of today's webinar. So we are hosting a series of webinars to begin a conversation about how the Superfund Research Program can establish infrastructure to provide opportunities for grantees to share and integrate data. Data sharing is an NIH priority and represents tremendous potential to accelerate the pace and practical impacts of environmental health research. As Bill is sure to say, SRP is very interested in your ideas and your expertise in these early stages and throughout the process. Please do not hesitate to share your thoughts or ask questions during the webinar or by contacting SRP staff directly. In today's webinar, we will hear from four speakers, two from NIHS to set the stage for the webinar series, and two researchers to present examples of ongoing projects that involve large amounts of complicated and diverse data. Dr. William Sook is the director of the SRP, and he will describe data diversity within the program and the prospect of integrating multidisciplinary research data to better understand human exposure and health outcomes and to reduce hazardous exposures. Dr. Alan Deary is the director of the Office of Scientific Information Management at the NIEHS, and he will discuss moving biomedical research towards a digital enterprise, including the Trans-NIH Big Data to Knowledge, the BD2K initiative, and steps that are being taken by the NIHS. Dr. Stephen DeMarco is professor of oceanography and ocean observing at Texas A&M University, and he'll present on how international initiatives in ocean observing systems are producing global data at unprecedented rates in the geoscience disciplines. He'll also describe how these data are being used to address ocean impacts on human health and society like harmful algal blooms, coastal hypoxia, ocean acidification, oil spill response, and hurricane preparedness. Finally, Dr. David Cayley, director of the Computer Architecture Research Laboratory at Northeastern University, will describe his work to manage and integrate data from the Puerto Rico test site for exploring contamination threats, or PROTECT, to study transport, exposure, health impact, and remediation of contaminants. So our first speaker is Dr. William Sook, who is director of both the Hazardous Substance Research Branch and the Superfund Research Program in the NIEHS Division of Extramural Research and Training. He has served since its inception as the director of the NIEHS Superfund Research Program, a program established by Congress as part of the reauthorization of Superfund in 1986. It fosters interdisciplinary research approaches to address the problems associated with potentially hazardous environmental exposures. He received his PhD in microbiology from the George Washington University Medical Center and his master's in public health and health policy from the School of Public Health at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. So with that, Bill, I'll let you go. You go ahead with your presentation.
Okay, great. Well, thank you, Michelle, and thank everybody for putting this entire webinar together. And I want to especially thank the other presenters. Sorry about that. I'm just, really excited. Because of the wealth of the data in the Superfund Research Program, tackling data challenges and finding ways to integrate data is a new opportunity to improve the SRP. The SRP is a mature program with over 28 years of programmatic and research successes. The SRP has led the way in support of the multi-transdisciplinary research needed to address complex human health and environmental sciences issues related to hazardous substances. Obviously, I feel that the next step in the evolution is to increase collaboration to include not only sharing of ideas and approaches, but to enable sharing of data. The NIEHS Superfund Research Program funds university-based multidisciplinary research on human health and environmental sciences issues related to hazardous substances. The primary goal is to understand and break the link between chemical exposures and disease. The Superfund Research Program is conducted in accordance with the Superfund Amendments and Reauthorization Act, otherwise known as SARA, of 1986. The mandate specified in SARA described the program's primary objectives to be the development of, and they're listed here, but I'm going to read them, methods and technologies to detect hazardous substances in the environment. The second one is the development of advanced techniques for the detection, assessment, and evaluation of the effects of human health of hazardous substances. Number three is the development of methods to assess the risks to human health presented by hazardous substances. And the fourth one is very unique to any program at NIH, and it is the development of basic biological, chemical, and physical methods to reduce the amount and toxicity and or of toxicity of hazardous substances. Essentially, this is the primary prevention program. So the SRP uses multiple funding mechanisms to support research, including individual research projects, small business grants, training and education programs, and multi-project centers. These SRP multi-project centers are the mainstay of the program and bring many of these disciplines together in the same center to bear on complex problems. Each multi-project center, and you can see an array of different themes here, center includes a variety of health and environmental disciplines, as well as training, outreach, and research translation, all tied together and integrated under a unifying theme. This unifying theme at each center helps link the projects in different research domains. Some centers are linked with a unified theme related to a specific contaminant or groups of chemicals, such as arsenic and mercury, or polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, PAHs. A few other examples of themes relate to nutrition and Superfund toxicity, risk assessment, developmental and reproductive toxicity of Superfund-related chemicals, and regional hazardous waste issues. In keeping with the NIEHS mission, teams of diverse professionals develop, test, and implement unique solution-oriented approaches to complex environmental health problems. They are improving our understanding of environmental health contaminants, which may lead to lower environmental cleanup costs, reduced impact of exposure, and improvements in human health. Now, this map of publications from the SRP shows all publications distributed based on the journals that published the work. This diversity of research across the science spectrum helps to illustrate the depth and diversity of the data being generated by the program. Just to put it in context, this is from three grant mechanisms, P42, which is the Centers Program, the R01s, and the SBIR, the Small Business Programs, of research that was published and searched for in PubMed and the Web of Science from 2008 to 2012. This is 951 publications over essentially a four-year period of time. So I think this is a pretty cool diagram, actually. The SRP grantees are working in a variety of fields from chemistry and biology, basic research, earth science research, biomedical research, to social science research, et cetera, et cetera. Since the SRP has been around since 1987, There is also a wealth of historical data that needs to be tapped into. This huge diversity of data, including historical data, presents an opportunity for the SRP. By integrating all of these types of data and sharing them across the different disciplines and research projects, we may be able to answer in more depth important questions related to reducing the burden of disease and improving human health. Because of the complexity surrounding exposure to environmental agents and health effects, coming at questions from a wide range of angles will answer tough questions. The diversity within the program also presents an opportunity to take advantage of new resources and broaden data available to researchers. We want to help researchers in different research domains become aware of and understand data resources in other research domains. This will help scientists better understand data diversity and take advantage of data sharing. It will also help to break down barriers that prevent us from discovery. So, the SRP is unique. I feel is in a unique position because we have a huge variety of types of data. For 26 years, the SRP has been bringing together research domains that do not normally meet under the same roof. We want to take that to the next level. We want to take advantage of that and take it to the next level and bring diverse data formats from a variety of scientists, from engineers to microbiologists and everybody in between, and people I didn't even mention, integrating diverse data to enhance environmental health knowledge. Ultimately, by integrating and sharing data across these different research domains, we intend to enhance the knowledge base, enhancing environmental health solutions through data integration, and thereby reducing the burden of disease and improving health. So, you've seen this picture before to some extent. So now we're going to try to put the pieces together. To begin to accomplish this, we have to figure out how to put these pieces together. Here are a few questions we need to address to begin moving forward toward integrating data. These questions emphasize the need for data sharing, which is an NIH priority. Data sharing is essential for expedited translation of research results into knowledge to improve human health. So how do we get there? We are very interested in your thoughts and would like to benefit from your experience and expertise. Here are some thoughts to begin the conversation. We know we have diverse science. This diversity of science is our strength. We need to take full advantage of it. How can the diverse science within the SRP be used together and shared? Next thought. We know researchers are already talking to each other, but how do we take it to the next level and enable projects to share data with other projects and centers? How do we make this data available and more usable to everyone? How do we encourage researchers to leverage existing data? We want your input on these questions. If you have thoughts or examples that may be useful, please get in touch with me to discuss them. The SRP has a variety of different kinds of data across multiple platforms. We want to figure out how to integrate these data across platforms and create a new knowledge architecture. To do this, we need to discuss and develop ways to inventory the data we already have. We also should consider creating repositories to store and collect data. By creating and integrating and environmental health knowledge architecture, we will achieve four things and then some. We will enhance collaborations and communications among environmental health science investigators. We will integrate investigator-initiated research. We will seize upon emerging scientific opportunities. And we will manage knowledge to meet public health and disease burden outcomes and products. As a segue into Alan Deary's presentation, who is coming up next, who will discuss how NIH is beginning to address issues related to big data, including the four V's of big data: volume, velocity, variety, and veracity. As we have just heard, the SRP definitely has the variety. So looking forward, we are interested in seeing what other agencies and programs are doing in the realm of big data and using this information to work towards integrating SRP data across multiple platforms in order to enhance the knowledge base and protect human health. Thank you very much for your attention, and I'm going to turn it back over to Michelle.
Thank you, Bill. That was a great presentation. We've got a few minutes for some questions. If anyone would like to answer or to ask them, you can do it through the question pod or you can do it through your phone line. Just remember to unmute your phone by *6 and pound. Wait a minute. Did I get that wrong? Dean, if you're on the line, you can jump in.
That's correct. *6 will take a caller off of mute. *6 will remute your line at any point. So again, if you have a question or a comment, you can come off of mute by hitting *6.
Great. Thank you. I had it wrong on my little sticky note and realized that it was, and then I'm glad you're here to bail me out. Thank you, Gene. And so I see a few questions have come through the pod, so I'm going to ask a few and see how Bill can handle a few of them. We also have Alan Deary on the line and Steve DeMarco and David Cayley on the line. So if any of you want to provide some input, I'd ask you to do this too, because this is really a time for SRP to hear what your thoughts are in the community. So we have a question: standardized research metadata is required, and USGS to standardize data metadata. However, it's not, this level of metadata in the research realm has not been seen. So I believe Stephen DeMarco is going to address a little bit of that during his presentation, but I don't know if any of the speakers have anything extra they'd like to add.
This is Alan. I would just add that standards development, including metadata, is a real need across all of biomedical research, and it is something that the BD2K program is very actively pursuing.
Okay, great, thanks. And what I've seen here is we've got some questions that have come through that, Alan, I think we will save them for after your presentation to ask you. I don't see any more other questions coming to the Q&A pod, so if there's anybody who on the phone lines would like to ask a question, please feel free to do that now, pressing *6 to unmute your line. And also know that we've carved out some time at the end, so if your question comes at the end and you'd like to ask it to Dr. Sook, you can go ahead and do that, or you can email him directly. So I don't hear any other anybody coming through the lines, and I don't see anything coming through the question and A pod. And please know, I do see some questions that I'm going to save because I think they might be a bit more appropriate. Since 1990, as Director of the Office of Scientific Information Management at NIHS, he provides senior leadership in the effort to define, plan, and evaluate scientific data and knowledge management approaches in environmental health. Before coming to the NIH, Deary received a PhD in anatomy from the University of Pennsylvania, was a postdoctoral fellow at the University of California, Berkeley, and an assistant professor of cell biology and ophthalmology at Duke University Medical Center, where he cloned the gene for the human D1 dopaminergic receptor. So, Alan, I am going to give it to you.
Thank you, Michelle. So I'm going to try to just give you sort of a quick whirlwind tour of some of what NIH and NIEHS are thinking about and doing with respect to data science and biomedical research. And so this introductory slide really builds upon Bill's slide, at least with respect to volume. We are just simply inundated with the amount of data that we produce. So for example, 25 years ago, all the information contained in the National Center for Biotechnology Information would fit on 3 floppy disks, if you happen to recall what those are. And a few years later, it would sit on 1 CD-ROM. And now it really would occupy vast warehouse volumes to try to contain those data. So a couple of years ago, NIH maybe belatedly started to recognize this issue and decided to try to do something to address it. So we developed what we refer to as a Big Data to Knowledge, or BD2K program, which has 4 foci. One of those is enhancing data sharing and usage. A second is improving our analytical tool set. A third is workforce development and training. And a fourth is centers. We have funded a set of 12 BD2K centers, all of which share a common theme of trying to integrate or make more interoperable the diversity, the variety of data across biomedical research that Bill also alluded to. So the BD2K program was initiated in terms of funding with a little over $30 million in the last fiscal year. That investment will grow over the next 5 years. And it's funded by all of the NIH institutes and centers. And so the nice little colorful balloons over here really just tell you some of the specific separate initiatives contained within the BD2K program as a whole. And a second related issue that we face in terms of data science is, one, the fact that the NIH budget is relatively flat or potentially declining into the future. And at the same time, two, the number of biological databases just continues to expand exponentially. So along with that growth in the number of data sets comes an increased cost. So it does become a bit of a question about the sustainability or the viability of that type of research operation over time. So to try to address that issue of sustainability, NIH is looking at 3 different elements: policy, infrastructure, and community. And I'll just give you one example of how we're starting to examine each of those domains. So in terms of policy, I think both Michelle and Bill have alluded to data sharing. And some of you may already be aware that there is indeed a new NIH genomic data sharing policy that expanded what we previously had as a GWAS data sharing policy to all genomic studies, whether human or animal, and regardless of cost. And there will be new data sharing plans for all research awards funded by NIH forthcoming. Those are intended to be machine readable and to have a link between wherever the data are stored and the grant number that produced those data. So the idea underlying that last point is to start to provide some acknowledgement, some attribution, some provenance for data, not just publication. And in terms of infrastructure, NIH is considering what we call a commons, which is a bit of a jargon term, but really a commons just refers to a collaborative shared space or environment that contains research objects. And research objects include data, plus software, plus standards. And each of those research objects has its own identifier. So that will enable the discoverability of all of those types of research objects with hopefully a user-friendly interface provided. Software, for example, can be packaged into what are called containers, which are really just similar to applications that you might have on your cell phone, for example. And all of this exists on a computing platform, which enables scientists to work together jointly as teams to store and analyze data. And so most likely at this point, that's some type of cloud-based platform. And the idea of that type of commons or shared collaborative space is that by being able to house all the research objects in one environment, it becomes a much more cost-effective operation. And in terms of community, I would say NIH is developing some new ideas about training. So for example, we are supporting a workforce development center, which is intended to coordinate the vast number of data science courses and training activities that are underway. We're developing some short-term training opportunities, internships and rotations and online courses, the type of thing that NIH has heretofore not done very much of. And we are trying to really promote the discipline of data science as a separate entity and increase the workforce with that type of quantitative skill set. So over the past few years, I would say there's been not only advances in science and advances in technology and computing, but importantly, there's also been this growing interest on the part of the public to participate in research. And the little bar graph in the bottom right is admittedly very hard to see, but those are data from a 2013 survey by Research America about patients willing to share health information for a variety of reasons. And the first bar at the top there is to work with researchers to improve prevention and treatment of disease. And 74% of the American public is willing to share its health information for that purpose. So that the confluence of all of those advances in science and technology and the interest in working with the public has led to what we at NIH refer to as a precision medicine initiative. And this is not an entirely new concept. For example, this is a diagram from a 2011 NRC report on precision medicine. And it just sort of gives you a cartoon view of how such an initiative might work. So on the left-hand column, for example, is biomedical research, which produces its own mechanistic findings and results. And on the right-hand column is clinical medicine, which produces electronic health records. So the idea is that by being able to combine the data from both research and from clinical care, we will be able to gain more knowledge about exposures, genes, epigenetics, microbiome, patients' behaviors and lifestyles, and that the accumulation of that knowledge and the ability of both researchers and clinicians to share and analyze that information jointly will lead to improvements in both the research that we carry out in terms of better understanding mechanisms and developing markers and targets, as well as in clinical care and diagnosis and treatment of disease. So that's the theory, that's the idea of a concept of precision medicine. And really, it's just been over the last 5 years, I would say, that this has even become a feasible enterprise to consider. Both the cost and the time of sequencing have decreased dramatically over the past decade. And at the same time, the number of mobile phones, electronic medical record adoption, and computing power have increased. So it's really just now, I would say, that we have the capacity to be able to carry out this type of effort. So the idea is to build a national research cohort of a million or more people, and that sample size might really offer us the capacity to test that idea of can we deliver the right drug at the right dose at the right time for the right person. So I'm going to give you just one example, really, of how this type of effort might help improve healthcare. So there's a gene, PCSK9, which controls the number of low-density lipoprotein receptors. And a loss of function mutation in that gene leads to an increase in the number of low-density lipoprotein receptors on the surface of liver cells, which in turn remove more LDL from the blood more quickly, which in turn decreases the amount of LDL cholesterol circulating in the bloodstream. So this might be a potential therapeutic target, for example, for prevention of cardiovascular disease. And this, again, this type of large scale cohort might enable us to also do a better job of studying what we refer to as resilience, that is of finding and identifying individuals who seemingly should be ill but are not. For example, there are a few people who have all three known genes for early onset familial Alzheimer's, yet don't express the disease. And heretofore, we have not really had the ability to understand that mechanism. And certainly, this will open up new paths to assess and evaluate mobile health technologies, which we will all be using more of in the future. So this type of effort takes a great array of partnerships between patients, providers, researchers, universities, industry, government, advocacy organizations, and others. And it takes all of the other elements that I've already mentioned, and obviously it takes a big focus of data science. So let me just quickly give you one example of how all of that can work together. So there is what's referred to as an Enigma consortium. It's not doing code breaking. It's actually one of the new BD2K centers. It consists of a worldwide network of researchers and cohorts, and it is studying many different neuropsychiatric disorders, which are listed in the bottom left. And so they are really trying to better understand neuropsychiatric disease, mostly by analyzing imaging data and genetic data. So this is just actually their first publication, which appeared a couple of months ago in Nature, in which they collected image and GWAS data from over 30,000 people in more than 30 countries. And so in order to do this type of scientific research, they really had to develop their own set of standardized protocols for data collection, data storage, data analysis, and data reporting. And so in this case, they found five genetic variants that influence the size, the volume of different brain regions like the caudate and the putamen. And so that type of work may have some findings for both neurological development as well as neuropsychiatric dysfunction. And obviously that work takes all of those elements that I've mentioned. It takes community, not just that group of researchers, but it takes funding from BD2K. And they actually do this through a crowdsourcing effort, meaning they invite others and the public to join in. It takes a lot of policy development in terms of data sharing, and it takes a lot of work on infrastructure, standards, compute, and software. So let me close by just telling you a bit about what we at NIEHS are doing. So one item is that we have established an Office of Scientific Information Management, which is very small in scale, but is actually unique across all of the NIH institutes and centers, in terms of having a centralized locus and focus on data science that tries to coordinate across everything that the institute does, whether it's intramural research or extramural research or national toxicology program. And just in response to the question about standards, we have done a lot of work over the past couple of years to try to, one, develop a vocabulary for environmental health sciences. So the vocabulary, in case you're not familiar with what we mean by that in this case, refers actually to the terminology, the nomenclature that we use to collect data and analyze data and share data and report out data. So for one example is just in terms of clinical care, for example, there are terms like newborn and neonate and infant, and so do those terms mean the same thing? Or what are the nuances in terms of distinction between those, and can those terms actually be made machine readable and machine interpretable? So the environmental health field, for example, does not have a very good common or shared vocabulary in contrast to other fields like genetics, which has a gene ontology and other features that really enable them to share data worldwide. So that's just one example of what we're doing to try to address data standards. The Institute has a number of staff who are leading some of the BD2K efforts in both training and sustainability. And we've done a lot, I would say, to try to open up the access and make reusable the data that we have produced within the Institute. So the most recent example is actually the third small bullet down there. So just yesterday at the White House, it was announced that we are promoting a challenge on climate change and human health. And the challenge is, again, just a way of crowdsourcing data to open it up to the public, to let them help analyze and interpret large data sets to try to expedite the findings that can be produced from that. With an international group called Research Data Alliance, we co-lead an interest group that's trying to make more interoperable toxicogenomics databases around the world. And some of you are probably aware that NIEHS has recently announced the opportunity for a Children's Health Exposure Assessment Research Data Science Center, which will, again, provide a lot more of the policy, infrastructure, community support that's needed to address data science. And again, there are a number of people within the Institute who have taken on senior and leadership roles, not only across all of NIH in terms of big data to knowledge, but also in working with other agencies. So I'll stop there. This is how you can get a hold of me, and this is how you can learn more about data science at NIH. And if there's any time, I'll be glad to address questions.
Yeah, we have time. Thanks very much, Alan. That was good. It's a lot to cover. There are some questions that came through the Q&A pod that I think are well suited to what you just presented. So one of them was a question about the preservation of, the sensitivities and privacy concerns of data. And so this one was a question about related to actual Superfund sites, but I think you might be able to speak to it based on the precision medicine. So how are privacies and sensitivities concerns addressed in precision medicine?
Right, so I didn't delve into that, but so even within BD2K, and I went through it pretty fast, if you went back to one of those colorful balloons, one of those relates to the use of clinical data in basic research. So obviously there are a lot, as you said, of concerns about privacy and confidentiality of patient data. And some of that is even more fundamental, I would say, to environmental health research, because it's not only the patient data, but often there's geospatial data, and some of the exposures are more hazardous for underserved communities. And so sometimes just having that sort of location information is, is sufficient to lead to some problems. And there's also, as everybody always points out, especially in environment and health, the potential for litigation. So for all those reasons, privacy and confidentiality are a pretty important issue. And so NIH is trying to really ensure that we are able to protect the confidentiality of especially electronic health records. Admittedly, that's why NIH, I would say, has been a little slow in terms of moving data to a cloud, for example. It's just trying to ensure the security of that data. So I think this is still an ongoing work in progress, but there's a lot of real attention being devoted to it across all of NIH.
Okay, yeah, thank you. And you're right, we're just sort of broaching this and there's a lot to consider, and we're sort of asking everyone here to sort of, as we're considering this, to bring forward your concerns and your opinions because we want to hear them. The other question we get a lot is, and we've also set up a poll about this, is about funding opportunities that there is available to accomplish data integration, so kind of integrating across data, diverse data sets. So the poll we put up is, you know, how hard is this? What barriers do people see coming? So if anyone would be kind enough who's participating in the webinar, we would love to hear your input on that. And Alan, for you, are you aware of any funding opportunities that are directly involved in overcoming data integration?
Yes. So at that website, datascience.nih.gov, you can find all of the past as well as present. There are a number of currently open funding opportunities for data science. A number of those happen to be in the training arena right now. But just earlier this year, for example, we had a funding opportunity announcement for supplements for interoperability. So supplements means you already have some type of existing grant award, but the idea was to be able to add on to that so that your data can be made interoperable and potentially integratable with other data sets. So I think you'll see more of this. This is really an important consideration in terms of sustainability, which I mentioned, and that cost driver for a lot of what we're doing in data science. So to the extent that data sets can become more interoperable and more harmonizable, the lower their overall cost becomes. So you'll see more of this than probably this year and definitely in FY16.
Okay, thanks. And this actually kind of ties into what you just said, Alan. I don't know if you can talk about any efforts that are being made on the part of NIH about cost sharing for, for things like servers to host and share data. Do you know if there's anything that's currently occurring or something that's sort of in the pipeline or something's available now that we could direct our attendees to?
Well, so there's probably sort of just the lack of general recognition that cost associated with data, storage, use, analysis, sharing can be part of any regular application, at least to NIH. And there's a more of a realization, I would say, that those costs are not only hardware, like servers, but they're often peopleware. So a large part of the cost associated with data is the curation of the data. So it's applying the metadata, and it's cleaning the data, and it's mungling the data. So that's a really needed resource that NIH has often underfunded in the past, but is now paying more attention to. So the basic answer to your question, Michelle, would be yes. There's a lot of resources that can now be brought to bear just through any type of grant mechanism to enable your data to be better taken care of.
This is good. And as you were saying, one of the biggest cost barriers is, people time to curate the data, QC it. And this is exactly the kinds of things that we're seeing coming up in the question we posed about perceived barriers that must be overcome when working with diverse data sets. So the attendees are agreeing with you. So,
okay.
Alan, thank you very much for taking the time to present for us, and I hope you'll be able to stay on the line.
Yes, I'm not an air. You might hear the jet. I'm at an airport.
I know you are. You know what? You did very well because we could hear no background, so very good.
Okay.
So
All right.
As long as you can stay on oceanography and ocean observing, lead at Texas A&M University. His research specializes in the interactions of physical and biogeochemical processes of the coastal and deep ocean. He has been the chief scientist on 30 oceanography research cruises. Currently, he serves as a member of the University National Oceanographic Laboratory System Ocean Observing Science Committee for the National Science Foundation. He leads a large group of 14 principal investigators from 7 institutions that are investigating the processes that lead to and sustain the hypoxic region of the northern Gulf of Mexico. From 2007 to 2014, he led the science team that investigated the physical and biological processes of the Sea of Oman in the northern Indian Ocean using a cabled array. He is co-PI and executive committee member of the Gulf Integrated Spill Research Consortium, funded by the Gulf of Mexico Research Initiative. He is also on the editorial board for Oceanography for Scientific World Journal and Datasets in Geosciences. DeMarco received his PhD and his MS in physics from the University of Texas at Dallas. So, Steve, we're happy that you can take some time and give us a presentation today, so I will leave it to you.
Great. Thank you, Michelle, for that introduction, and thanks for the organizers for the invitation, and thank you, listeners, for this opportunity to speak to you about some of the trends for integrated data and multidisciplinary research that is occurring in the field of ocean science, and particularly that of ocean observing. I'm an observational oceanographer, and I'm going to try to give you a high-level overview, beginning with some of the global initiatives that are occurring, and then begin to drill down to some of the national and regional activities in the U.S., and then conclude with some examples of my own research in the Gulf of Mexico. So ocean sciences, like many fields, have seen explosive growth in the amount of data that's being generated, and particularly that's being generated in real time. And this growth has been fueled by advances in new observational platform technologies, particularly those that deal with autonomous or unmanned systems, and then also new advanced sensor designs that have increased the suite of parameters and variables that are routinely measured in the ocean, and also at much faster data rates. The realization that many oceanographic problems are highly disciplinary using interdisciplinary, using physics, biology, chemistry, geology, all to solve those problems and require multivariate analysis and data-intensive approaches to provide solutions to those problems. And lastly, I will say that the observationist lament, which is you can't measure everywhere and all the time, this has also driven this move to these big data requirements. In 2013, the president of the Oceanography Society announced the era of big data comes to oceanography, and heralded that arrival of the fourth paradigm of data-intensive science with data exploration, which is the combination of theory, experiment, and simulation. The principal global ocean observing network is called GOOSE, the Global Ocean Observing System, whose goal is to provide information and observations of the ocean, including its living resources. It's comprised of two components, the global and the coastal, and it's designed to make observations for weather and climate and to improve the management of marine and coastal ecosystems and resources. GOOSE is made up of many, many platforms, which include the Argo Floating Network, the Drifting Buoy Network, ocean gliders, research vessels, commercial and cruising yachts, commercial ships, and mooring arrays, which I'll talk about shortly. GOOSE is part of the larger global Earth observing system of systems, and it's sponsored by several international organizations listed here in this slide. The INSET also shows the GOOSE regional alliances that include the U.S. component, which I'll talk about also. This slide shows the global coverage of ocean observing system platforms as of December 2014. It shows that approximately 67% of the planned initial implementation goal of in-situ networks is now deployed. This includes more than 250 volunteer observing ships, more than 3,200 Argo floats, 1,250 drifting buoys, and continuous satellite measurements. Also included in this are 87 time series stations and 125 moorings in the Global Tropical Buoy Network. Notice that the coverage density is highest at the tropical and equatorial regions and sparsest at high latitudes. At the turn of the 19th century, most of all oceanographic observations were done by bucket and bottle samples. This graphic shows the World Ocean Database by instrument type. Around the Second World War, electronic sensors became more practical. And after all, the ocean is very unforgiving. Salt water is highly corrosive, and abyssal depths are at very low temperatures and very high pressures. The MBT, which is the mechanical bathythermograph, and the XBT, which are the expendable bathythermograph, provide vertical profiles of temperature, and that was pretty much the bread and butter of oceanography in the middle part of the last century. These devices were deployed from a ship, so a vessel is required to physically transit to those locations. The CTD is the conductivity temperature depth instrument. It added this conductivity sensor, which allows for the determination of salinity, which will give you the density of salt water. The graphic shows that the middle part of the last century was dominated by these three systems. At the end of the 20th century, moored buoy observations and the Argo drifting network and ocean gliders began to dominate this network. In the last 10 years, observing systems have been placed on animals, particularly seals and other marine organisms. And they have shown a marked increase, particularly at regions not accessible by ship or other gliding platforms. Just an example, the Argo float program is one of the most successful ocean observing systems that's currently deployed. The lower insert at the right shows the latest reporting locations for the about 3,800 floats. They move up and down in the water column by adjusting buoyancy, and when at the surface, they transmit their data via satellite to shore locations. The glider sinks to a predetermined parking depth. In this figure, it shows it at 1,000 meters, and drifts with the ambient ocean currents for several days. At the end of that time, the floater it goes a bit deeper and then returns quickly to the surface to retransmit their data. Argo floats are typically instrumented with temperature and conductivity sensors with samples at about once per second. Many are being outfitted with dissolved oxygen sensors, partial CO2 sensors, dissolved nutrients such as nitrate and other sensors. And the data are made publicly available within 24 hours at the argo.net website. The use of Argo floats has greatly increased the cost of reduced the cost of a single vertical profile of temperature and salinity from about $15,000 in the 1990s to about $150 today. Moving on to what is known as the Ocean Observatories Initiative, this is perhaps the largest observing program in the U.S. and is funded by the National Science Foundation. It's a network of seven globally distributed sensor arrays with real-time access. These arrays consist of a cabled array in the Pacific Northwest, two coastal arrays, one in the East Coast and one on the West Coast, and four global arrays, which are stationed in the Northern Pacific, Northern Atlantic, and in the Southern Ocean and the Southern Atlantic. The arrays are made up of more than 800 instruments representing 50 different instrument classes. There's on the order of 50,000 sensors on these instrument types. They're made up of network buoys, profiling moorings, static moorings, gliders, and bottom-mounted packages. Some have high-definition video, which stream live footage of abyssal conditions back to shore in real time. The system is presently awaiting full commissioning of all components, but many elements are reporting data via the OOI web portal. About a terabyte of data are collected per day by the OOI. The Integrated Ocean Observing System is a NOAA-administrated national regional partnership that provides observing tools and forecasts to predict severe weather, forecast ocean hazards, and predicts threats to human health. IOUS, which we refer to it, is the U.S. contribution to the Global Ocean Observing System, GOES. And it's operationally divided into 12 independent regional associations that cater to specific regional interests and stakeholders. IOUS data are publicly available through a system of distributed portals maintained by the Regional Data Association. Some national programs like the High Frequency Radar Network and the Glider Network have their data administrated directly by the National IU's office. It's difficult to have an estimate for what the data rates of IU's is presently, but suffice it for this talk to say that a dozen regional associations represent hundreds of data providers each who operationally run thousands of systems with tens of thousands of sensors. Now I'll turn to some specific examples of how ocean observing systems have been used to address specific ocean systems. In general, ocean systems are used to address problems at many different times and spatial scales. Sustained long-time or long-term observations, meaning decades in length, can address issues such as climate change and ocean acidification. In the short term, meaning on the orders of hours, days, and months, ocean observing systems are used for issues like oil spill response, hurricane prediction, coastal hypoxia, and harmful algal blooms. Next, I'll show two examples of the long-term issues and then follow that with a couple of the short-term examples. So this slide shows an example of the way the global databases have been used to show patterns in global basins of the ocean. This particular graphic shows the 50-year trends in ocean surface salinity that have occurred. The patterns are based on analysis of very large data sets of surface observations taken from multiple platforms and different instrument types. On the right are the mean salinity values, and left are the linear trends in salinity units per year. The graph shows considerable interbasin contrast as the Atlantic is seen to be getting saltier and the Pacific Ocean getting fresher. The mechanism is thought to be due to amplification of the Earth's hydrological cycle due to warmer atmospheric temperatures, which would subsequently impact evaporation. This next show further shows the importance of long-term series of observations in the ocean context. The top left shows observations of partial CO2 pressure in the Sargasso Sea at the Bermuda BATS time series station. These observations represent the largest ocean acidification time series in the world. The trend shows a clear increase in the surface PCO2 concentration during the last 40 years, with a corresponding decrease in pH and aragonite. This translates into a pH change of about negative 0.0017 per year, or about 25 to 30% increase in acidity of seawater over the past 40 years. So moving a bit more regionally, in April 2010, the Deepwater Horizon platform exploded, killing 11 people and spilling nearly 5 million barrels of oil into the Gulf of Mexico. At the time of the spill, there was no ocean observing system in place in the Gulf of Mexico to track the movement of water and therefore of the oil and the gas plumes. So the resulting oil and gas slick had to, at the surface and the subsurface intrusion layer had to be done based mostly with 20th century oceanographic methodologies. In 2012, the Gulf Integrated Spill Response, GISER Consortium, funded by the Gulf of Mexico Research Initiative, GOMRI, deployed a scales array in the vicinity of the Deepwater Horizon, which is located just north of the star, the red star in this map. I was the designer of that and the lead investigator for this array, and the purpose was to establish metrics for the temporal and spatial scales of variabilities in the region and to provide current velocity data during a controlled dye release, which would simulate a spill in the Gulf of Mexico. Six moorings were deployed, shown as the green dots and the red star, and each mooring consisted of multiple instruments distributed throughout the water column. The small inset on the left shows the context of historical current velocity measurements in the Gulf of Mexico, and notice that there's sparse data coverage in that location historically. This next here is an animation. I hope it plays. They're bringing it up here. That is great. It shows the three-dimensional temporal evolution as it comes up. I'll just read through my notes here of the current velocity from this geyser array. And shown are the local bathymetry in gray. At the surface is the near surface surface height based on satellite altimeter data, so we're using a lot of different data in this. The vertical scale is roughly 3,000 meters in depth, and horizontally it's about 250 by 350 kilometers, so it's exaggerated for the vertical here. At the time of the observations, a small cyclone was positioned over the mooring arrays, an oceanographic cyclone, making the currents move counterclockwise. And notable in this is that the lower water column is moving basically southwest, while the north the surface is moving in a different way, showing that the surface and the bottom is decoupled and not phase locked. So this is typical of currents in the deep ocean, and particularly at this location. The dye that was released was nearly at 1,200 meters of water depth, and it corresponds to the depth of a methane gas intrusion at the time of the spill. The spill moved southwest initially, and this was confirmed in later measurements chemically of the dye plume. If the predictions were based just on surface feature tracking, the predicted movement would have been in the opposite direction as those that were observed. And we had to go to a numerical circulation modeling for this too, which as part of our study, which tended to under-predict the magnitudes of the currents in the lower layers, saying that that is available locally. The last example I have here is that of coastal hypoxia, or low oxygen concentrations in coastal waters. These nicknamed dead zones are regions that have the potential to kill marine life if oxygen levels are too low to sustain life. In 2008, as this graphic shows, Diaz and Rosenberg reported that more than 400 of these dead zones existed worldwide, and that number tends to double every decade, and that number is now well over 500. Next slide there. The Gulf of Mexico hypoxia is the largest of the hypoxic zones in the Western Hemisphere, and it's driven by the combined effects of high phytoplankton growth fueled by high nutrient fluxes coming down the Mississippi River. The high productivity increases the flux of organic material to the lower water column through sinking cells and zooplankton fecal pellets, and the strength of the pycnochine that prevents oxygen from diffusing down from the upper layers causes oxygen depletion at the bottom. In fall, strong winds and declining freshwater volume breaks down the stratification and ventilates the bottom waters. Hypoxia is typically found near bottom and stratified waters between 10 and 40 meters total water depth. The upper panel shows a MODIS true color satellite image of the Northern Gulf, showing the distribution of surface phytoplankton across the region. And the lower panel on the right shows a spatial distribution of near bottom oxygen concentration in June 2008. Hypoxia here is defined as 2 milligrams per liter. In 2008, the observed hypoxic area was 31,000 square kilometers and covered much of the shelf region. This graphic just shows the vertical structure of properties in the water column. The thin black line is salinity and shows fresher water near the surface and saltier water at the bottom. The red line shows oxygen concentrations as a function of depth, and clearly the oxygen levels decrease dramatically in the lower layers beneath the stratified layer. This was supposed to be a animation. However, we had some technical difficulties with here, so I'll just say what these are. The links here are above if you want to take a look at these, but this is a simulation for the year 2008, which shows panels of surface salinity on the left and bottom oxygen on the right. The simulation begins in January, and what you would see here is a time development of the two fields throughout the year. And you would see the development of hypoxia, or red colors on the right, responding to the Mississippi effluent coming down on the left panel as blue colors. There's a lot of details in these animations here, and I'm not going to go into, but what I would like to say about it is it shows that there is a high patchiness. This was something that came across with the numerical models that we were using. It's high spatial patchiness and high temporal patchiness. And so in order to address this particularly, we deployed some gliders. These are oceanographic gliders in this dead zone in 2008. This experiment was done using two Teledyne Webb Research Slocum G2 buoyancy gliders, which were configured for shelf applications. The maximum depth of these gliders was about 200 meters. These are shown here in the right panels. Each glider was equipped with a CTD system. It had fluorometers to measure chlorophyll and colored dissolved organic material, and it also had dissolved oxygen sensors positioned on these. Data were collected at about 1 hertz or 1 per second and resulted in about 500,000 observations for this 30-day deployment that I'm about to show you. About 1% of those come back in real time via satellite, Iridium satellite. I should also say those were buoyancy gliders. They go beneath the surface. We also have in our arsenal surface gliders that stay at the surface, and these are propelled mostly through the rocking motion indicated to them by the surface gravity waves that are there, the wind waves that are there. We deployed these on the shelf. This is a graphic showing that deployment on the shelf. And it was really to measure if we could use these gliders in the shelf environment. The right inset in this shows some of the challenges that is associated with glider deployments on a continental shelf. Each red dot in that inset there is representative of one of the more than 5,000 oil and gas platforms that occupy the Texas and Louisiana shelf region. And these are things that we want to avoid. This is showing the data from one of the missions, and it's a time series. As a function of depth for what we're calling Mission 8. The upper right shows the upper panel shows the salinity, the dissolved oxygen as a function of depth. It represents about 500,000 points, as I said. The thick blue line depicts bottom oxygen as observed by the glider's altimeter sensor, and it is clear that the gliders consistently came close to the bottom during this mission. It shows multiple occurrences of low oxygen near bottom. The deep blue patterns represent this hypoxic layer. The lower panel shows the salinity structure encountered during the mission. And as expected, fresh water of about 32 to 33 dominates the upper water column, and this is fresh. Salty dense water of about 35 occupies the lower water column. So we feel that the spatial variability that was seen in the modeling was very much represented by the gliders here. Since it takes only about a half an hour for the glider to go up and down, this is in contrast to taking hours to do this using traditional methods from a ship. This next slide here just shows a histogram of it shows the data up on the upper panel, but it shows a histogram of how close we came to the bottom. And just for your perspective, know that that we were controlling these from Central Texas, and so these gliders came within a meter or two of the bottom consistently throughout this deployment, which is an indication of the great control that we have of these systems during these deployments. So I just want to have one more slide here to show. I have to mention here that all the flooding that we've experienced during the last couple of months in Texas has led to significant increases in river freshwater to the discharge to the Gulf of Mexico, and these will lead to enhanced stratification of that system and potentially to more coastal hypoxia. And I plan on Friday of this week to deploy two more gliders off of Galveston to monitor this situation more closely. So in conclusion, in this very short presentation, I hope I've given you a snapshot of how the global and regional perspectives of ocean observing and how new technologies are allowing for unprecedented data volumes that allow us to address a wide variety of ocean-related issues from the regional to the global. And I thank you very much for your attention.
This is a wonderful presentation. Thank you, Steve. And lots of data. I will remind everyone, if you have a question, please feel free to put it through the Q&A pod, or you can unmute your phone by pressing *6 and ask it through your phone. I'll just to kind of get everything started, we do have time for just a few questions. One question that did come through the Q&A pod was the data. You mentioned this Argo site, and all the data is being, some of your data at least, is being put into, uploaded into this site. So what kind of QC, QA goes into it before uploading it?
Yeah, so there's so that's done by the University of California, San Diego, and mostly through Scripps Institute of Oceanography as well. And also there's different groups at the University of Washington and other places around the country that take some of the Argo data. There's two different modes that they deal with. There is the real-time mode, which goes through mostly just range checking. We call that the sanity check to make sure that you're not the temperatures aren't on the surface of the sun, or the salinities aren't in the Dead Sea if you're in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico. And so so there's that sanity check that goes through, and then there's a post-cal or a delayed mode. That takes place, and these are more of a longer-term archiving of the data. So it's left to, if you want the real-time data, that you have the caveat that if something's too good to be true, it may not be. So you have to take due diligence to make sure that you also use that data wisely. The delayed mode is a bit more quality controlled, and there's national and international programs that go on overseeing some of the actual protocols that go on with that. And so temperature and salinity is something that oceanographers and others, limnologists, have used for a long time, hundreds of years, temperature for sure, salinity maybe 100 years. So the protocols are very much established, but other data sets which are coming online now, like DNA and or even nutrient data, these have had much shorter lifetimes, and so there's less developed protocols that are currently in place.
And related to the Argo site, there was a question about whether or not are you able to share the data from this site, or is this something that is password protected?
I think the Argo site right now is just you just register and you have full access to the data. They just want to know who's using the data, to make sure that they know who the community is, and that there may be a small questionnaire that they also have filled out. There's also since this is a global program, there is some issue with international boundaries, and so some countries require that the data, the actual temperature and salinity, and maybe the oxygen data are turned off while the Argo float drifts through different EEZs of different countries. So that's also a hurdle that we haven't talked about a little bit in this seminar, but maybe it's going to come up with the NIH data as well. What are the local customs and maybe the security requirements of different countries?
No, that's a very good point. With people sharing the data from this Argo site, how is it credited, or how is it attributed? So just thinking in terms of one of the currencies that our grantees have is publications. So is there some kind of, we got this data from the Argo site, please cite this, or is it just sort of open and free?
Yeah, so usually what's required for to use Argo data is to make sure that you, in at least in the acknowledgments, say where the data came from and acknowledge the program. If you're using specific PIs, it's up to the specific PIs of the Argo program sometimes to weigh in. I've used Argo data on several different publications, and just communicated the fact to them that we are we have a publication. It's under review, and usually what they say is make sure that you spell our name correctly in the acknowledgments.
Okay. There's a question here about data storage. I mean, obviously, you've got a lot of data that you're having to not only store but to integrate and manipulate. So how is that done? There was a question about whether or not they were stored in NetCDF and whether or not there is a plan to upload the big data into platforms such as Hadoop, Cassandra, or Mongo database.
Yeah, so the one that that takes a lot of the environmental geosciences data is EarthCube. However, I mean, there's a lot of answers to this question. As part of our funding, particularly from NOAA, we have to have a data management plan as part of the funding, and that includes the curating of the data, the archiving of the data at multiple sites, and also the uploading the data to national data archives like the National Ocean Data Center (NODC). Needs to go to like the National Climate Data Center and CDC, it goes there. But we have to say that up front in the proposals at the proposal stage, and then once we are funded, we have to establish contacts with the bigger groups. Internationally, there are like GOOS and other places have their own archiving, and some of these have mirrored archiving centers distributed throughout the world, and they have their own reporting requirements for that. NetCDF is the common data format, and that is one that we are using very often these days. It allows us to keep the metadata, which, as others have said, and I will echo, the metadata are as important as the data. It's just critical that metadata follow the data wherever they go, so people know about what the quality is of the data, how and when they were used, where, what type, all that is necessary information. So I hope that answers that multi-part question.
Yes, no, and good point about the metadata. I'm glad that you brought that up. We have one more question through the Q&A pod, and that is, how do you analyze the volume of data you have? Do you use R? And if you do, how do you process the scripts, and do you do it in the cloud?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. So from the observational point of view, I've used R. That's a good database, a statistical package that can do large databases. I tend, though, right now to use MATLAB, and there's probably people cringing about that, but it seems for the size of data sets that I have need for, it sometimes runs slow, but sometimes it runs okay. If I really needed number crunch, I use the program that God intended us to use, Fortran. That just, there is no replacement for just a dedicated Fortran program sometimes. Of course, that can't always be used because if you have to do very complex statistical analysis, you have to use a program that is maybe dedicated for that. So the numerical modelers, however, they use the supercomputers, and they have much, much bigger data sets that I'm encountering right now. We're still struggling with, I think, from the data perspective, from what OOI is about to deliver. These discussions are going on, and the vast volumes of data that the OOI is just right on the cusp of delivering is a series of a lot of upcoming workshops on how to exactly handle that data stream.
Thank you. And if you could, what we could do is as that information comes available when these workshops are coming up, we would love to distribute that to our audience. So if you could provide that to us, that'd be wonderful. Just in the interest of time, I will move on to the next speaker, but just remind everybody that if you do have a question, please put it through the Q&A pod, and we've carved up some time at the end. And also, if the speakers don't mind, what we can do is just maybe contact them directly with any questions that weren't answered during this webinar. So thank you very much, Steve. That was a great presentation. The next presentation and the final one is by David Cayley. Dr. David Cayley is a College of Engineering Distinguished Professor on Environmental and Civil Engineering Faculty at Northeastern University in Boston, where he directs the Northeastern University Computer Architecture Research Laboratory. Prior to joining Northeastern in 1993, Cayley spent 12 years at IBM, and the last seven were at T.J. Watson Research Center in Yorktown Heights in New York. He presently oversees the Data Management and Modeling Core for the NIHS P42 Protect Center based at Northeastern. David Cayley received both his BS and PhD in Electrical Engineering from Rutgers University and his Master of Science in Computer Engineering from Syracuse University. So we're looking forward to hearing what you have to say, David. Thanks again for agreeing to present.
Sure, and just one correction there. I'm a faculty in electrical and computer engineering. I'm not sure how, I'm sure my civil engineering colleagues are chuckling right now, but anyway.
Oh, no. Sorry about that. We'll correct that for the website. Thanks.
That's fine. So thank you. So just to give you a little perspective, I'm a computer engineer, and my role is to help a very diverse group of people try to answer important questions by managing their diverse data that's targeted at environmental health research. So going on to my first slide, the folks that I work with are physically distributed, as you can see. Northeastern is in Boston. We're working in two campuses in Puerto Rico at the University of Michigan. And we have collaborators at the University of West Virginia. So there's a lot of people that are contributing to both the data management, but also to the overall project aims and goals. Here's what I'm going to talk about I think I have 20 minutes for this presentation. Some of the challenges that we're having in terms of managing diverse environmental health data, particularly as it relates to this distributed center that we're currently running, PROTECT. I'll give you an overview of the data core and how we've actually organized ourselves and how we're functioning. I'll talk a little bit about and give you some examples of the data analytics and machine learning that we're applying to our broad set of data, and then some lessons learned, sort of retrospective. I mean, we're in year five of a center, and just give you some thoughts on maybe that are highly relevant for this community. So PROTECT is we're focused on contaminant threats that impact preterm birth in northern Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico in the United States has the highest incident of preterm birth. And we're currently, the center's been in existence since 2010. Our final cohort will be 1,800 expectant mothers. We're looking at what the contributions to environmental contaminants, where they come from, and their impact on preterm birth. We're also looking at detection and green remediation techniques to minimize or prevent exposure. And so obviously we're trying to find this relationship. We're trying to develop new technologies, but we're also trying to support information to the community as well and just general awareness around environmental health in the area. So in terms of the data that we work with, it's a very rich set of data. I've worked on other projects prior to this through an engineering research center managing data. I never encountered a data quite as rich and as diverse as what we're seeing in this center. And this includes everything from the different types of studies. So basically, we have six cores, and we have five projects, each with its own aims and deliverables. But we have information about Superfund sites, different types of groundwater, things taken from tap, the participants, which include both the expectant mothers and also the children, and of course, their birth outcomes. So a real rich diversity of data that is textual questionnaires, all types of things from in terms of blood and urine samples, placental samples, so a rich diversity of information. So what are some of our challenges? Well, first, we're distributed. Five university partners working toward a common goal, and physically distributed. So we have, because of the nature of the different types of data, we have pretty diverse data cleaning requirements. We're pretty rigorous in terms of our data cleaning, in terms of our approach, which requires a multi-step process, and I'll describe that a little bit as I get into some of the details. We also have a range of privacy and security issues related to the data, because we do, we have sensitive data. Definitely human subjects are a key part. And then finally, we're dealing with a very diverse group of people, experts in environmental engineering, biochemists, electrochemists, toxicologists, you name it, pediatricians, social scientists. So it's a real challenge for us to try to address everyone's needs through a common repository and a common set of services. So some of those specific challenges is, I think it was great. I think the first two speakers spoke perfectly and frame some of the challenges we've been encountering and have addressed in our own center is, building a common vocabulary across these disciplines. How do we do that? Well, we've done a good cut at it, at least for our particular center, and how that works with other environmental health projects. That's probably a good question, something that this presentation has helped me reflect upon. Also in terms of having common data importing and cleaning mechanism. Just the management, how are we gonna manage distributed data? We need a secure mechanism for transmitting data. Data that's transmitted needs to be in an either encrypted or, definitely de-identified entirely. In terms of, we want to have online distributed sharing. So now we put up a repository, how do we provide for some level of security. We'd like to be able to give users the ability to ask relational questions. We want to be able to export to a large number of formats, in terms of some people want mapping, some people want R, some people want Excel, whatever it is. I think this is part of our challenge. And, each project has its own needs. So it has to be on a per project basis to serve the needs of the entire program. So those are some of the challenges. Let's move on to what the data management and modeling core does within PROTECT. So we're responsible for the collection, storage, security management of human subject, biological, survey, environmental, and additional data. And we've leveraged a number of commercial software packages very effectively. We use the commercial grade of Dropbox, which gives us a level of security that is appropriate for the data that we're managing. We're using REDCap for our first level of data cleaning. And we're using a package from EarthSoft, which is EarthSoft, for those of you that aren't in environmental engineering, is a environmental engineering management software that comes with a back-end database system and is used for managing environmental projects. Basically, we have the ability for cleaning and reliable storage through first Dropbox that allows us to have both data transfer and backup. We utilize REDCap for cleaning, particularly right now for all the human subject, but we're presently working to do the same for our environmental and for some of our other data as well. We want to be able to, one of the key things, and we learned early on, is because we have these projects contributing their information, we needed a data model where we could cross-index all of the data. So we're basically we cross-index every data entry by either a subject ID or a time and space, space being GIS coordinates. So we can put a participant that's participating in the program to a GIS location, particular time, and an ID. And then all other data is also cross-indexed appropriately. We provide tools for data inventory analysis and mining that where we have a global data dictionary. So from day one, we decided everyone's going to agree on a common vocabulary across, you know, for every entity in the system. We also have inventory tools that really help us track our status. You know, we meet weekly and basically are updating status and you know, we're in a data campaign right now to basically build our database in terms of the data. And then what are our exports and analysis using the Equus tool? We're using Equus Enterprise for that. Here's the kind of data. So I wouldn't call this big data. I mean, we have over a billion data points in our database. It's the diversity. So I call this small big data in the sense that the diversity of the data makes it challenging. And this is the present data in the database. Where we also will have quite a bit of additional data as we have more participants, as we are sampling more wells, and for all of those samples, doing more targeted and non-targeted analyses. So a really rich array of data to try to challenge us with. So in terms of our producers, this is our workflow where data is coming in from distributed sites, and they may be analyzed sites, CDC reports, or they may be you know, straight from a tap water sample that's been you know, where a test is done locally within the home. All of that data is recorded, comes into Dropbox. We also for the human subject data, all of the data down at the medical campus in Puerto Rico is first entered into REDCap that provides one level of cleaning. The export of that comes into our system. We use a tool within EarthSoft's Equus called EDP that is basically builds another level of cleaning that's a little bit more rigorous than REDCap in terms of looking at cross-dependencies across fields. So there's two levels of cleaning that are done on most of the data that's in the database. So we have a repository within Equus. We basically use SQL Server as our back end. That's what the EarthSoft software expects, though it does also work with Oracle as well, if you so prefer. On our back end, we basically have a number of different tools and export formats to target whether it's our researchers, whether this is for education or training, or it could be for community engagement. And we're presently working through, you know, what's the appropriate information that we're going to be providing to the general community out there, working with our community engagement and also our research translation cores. So we have over, multi-billion records in this very sophisticated database. And now at this point, you know, we are starting to ask a lot of very interesting questions. And because of the way we've designed it, we have the complete capability to analyze them efficiently. So So that's what we're in the process of doing, as well as continuing with our data campaign. So just to review, so we're taking in lots of different data, biological, human, subject, and environmental, into REDCap, which basically helps us with getting through a level of cleaning, into EarthSoft, where we're using Equus Professional and Enterprise, and it provides us with a lot of different functionalities. We've recently moved from Professional, which was more or less a standalone product, didn't have a web-looking back end, and we've moved to Enterprise, which is where we are now. And that gives us the ability to build customized dashboards for each of the projects that we're working with. And so basically, you can look at your data from a raw perspective. You can look at the data schema. You can look at the data dictionary. You can start to you'll have built-in widgets that will allow you to run analyses on the data that are customized for the needs of your project. Also, you fully have the ability to export data. Each user has authority and permissions to access a subset of the data as appropriate, and all of that is through approval of each of the PIs of the different projects. So there's a whole policy for doing that and a process. So having covered a little bit of what the Protect data looks like in the database, I just want to give you some examples. And if you're going to ask me questions probably about the details of some of these analyses, I'd have to defer them, but happy to follow up with you with them, with the actual PIs on each of the projects. So, but it shows some of the richness of the data. For instance, this is from John Meeker's lab at Michigan, looking at, through target analysis, so phthalates is one of our targeted chemicals that we're looking at, and we're looking at the distribution throughout the pregnancy, so over time. And the visit number is, first visit, second visit, third visit for the expectant mother, and looking at the phthalate distributions as measured. So again, you can see that time and the chemical analyses that are done give us some very rich data. We are also, we have 20 additional variables that we're looking at that really give us lots of different outcomes that we can look, so we can tie these back to everything about where the participant lives, what they're drinking, all the Superfund information, which I'll show you in just a second. It really helps us build this cause and effect in a relationship pretty broadly. And again, we're a little early to start to ramp this up to start to answer some of the program level questions, just because our cohort is still developing. But we are going to be looking at additional biomarkers and chemicals in these types of analyses. So next, I'm going to load a set of slides here. So if it takes a second, please forgive me. This is work that's done, again, in Puerto Rico, but at the University of Puerto Rico at Mayagüez by Ingrid Padilla's lab. This is looking at CBOCs across our study area, and looking at it over a period of a number of years and seeing how things have changed. We also, snap to the map the active superfunds as well as inactive, and landfills and other areas within the geographic region. But again, you can see that we have time here as well as space, and then concentrations as measured by water samples. So this, I believe, was done with well samples. And this is just, in terms of the sampling that's done here, Ingrid's lab is continuing to sample additional wells. There's an ongoing tap water testing as well that takes place. So we really have a lot of data in terms of environmental. And, we also have a lot of historical data that we can also use for the region as well, as we're looking at some of the this whole area is a karst area, and we're looking at the fate and transport issues that are leading to some of these problems in terms of contamination. So the last study is done here at Northeastern through, this is for the non-targeted analysis in Roger Giese's group. We've been working with them to try to, they're currently analyzing urine samples from the expectant mothers and using mass spec to actually identify chemicals present in the samples. And we have samples from both from the study group and from another group of individuals in Boston. Right now, this particular, just for this simple getting our routine down, is we're looking at six different samples, but that leads to millions of these pairs of intensities and mass spec values, so the mass to charge ratios. So the non-targeted analysis project engaged the data core to say, how could we start to accelerate some of this processing? So we, my first expertise is in parallel computing. So this was perfect, but really this was we had some simpler things we had to address first. And that was we needed to take from the mass spec machine and take their customized software and basically rewrite it ourselves. We also needed to come up with a better way to identify the compounds present in the samples. So we employed PCA in terms of, principal component analysis to get our processing down from days and hours to minutes and almost seconds. So in terms of how our workflow changed, so basically they started, and this is just six urine samples with 1,176 data files where we had to do peak picking to actually identify the important points for each of the potential chemicals. We merged those in and then applied a filtering to get down to a 5,000 by 1,176 matrix, perform PCA on this, and basically this data flow was sped up 100 times. So we basically have reduced the processing. And again, this isn't big data, but by the time we have 1,800, and we're not going to be working with 1,800 urine samples probably, but in the future, the number of samples is going to grow significantly, and we're trying to help speed that particular processing as well. And this happens to be the results that we produced, and we're still doing further work in this project, but we had a recent paper that described the outcome of this analysis. So when we're looking at this very diverse data, some of the things that we're seeing is the high dimensionality. So basically, the first visit data for when the expectant mothers come in and an interviewed by the nurse, there's 240 attributes, and the second visit's more than 800 attributes. That's, if you're trying to do some type of feature selection to be able to cluster this or do some analysis. And then also to add to this, we're seeing mixed sparsity in the data. So the first visit and second visit have very different characteristics. And then finally, the data types we're working with, we have numerical data, we have categorical data, and all different types of data. So a real challenge in terms of our analyses. We're presently, we work closely on other projects, and we're leveraging those relationships to bring in machine learning to actually try to cluster data in, when the data is a little bit more complex than just, say, your Netflix ratings, which are commonly a target for a lot of machine learning studies. We have a lot of missing data here. We need to look at this as possibly a combination of clustering techniques, given the nature of the data, and then combine them together to actually find hidden patterns in the data. And that's what we're exploring right now and developing those capabilities in the back end of our database system. So we have integrated data along with a set of tools for each of the projects. So to finish this up, I'd just like to present a couple of lessons learned from Protect so far. Obviously, given the nature of the data that we're working with, security and privacy have to be baked in from the beginning. And that has happened with Protect. And I think that the need for that is going to just grow and grow, particularly as we start to share data. We've been extremely careful with setting up protocols in terms of reporting geographic information as well as human subject information that's completely de-identified. And where that information that would compromise that level of privacy, that we're very careful about how we manage our information. We have this comprehensive data dictionary across the entire program. We probably should be looking at beyond the borders of Protect, and I think that's a great suggestion. Sorry. Working with a centralized data management has helped us. Trying to do this across different sites, I think, would be a bit of a challenge and lead to inconsistencies. And given the web and where internet technology is developed, I think we have all the capabilities that we need to be able to do this efficiently. Having tools to track our progress have been key to understanding, and that's all helped us with our data quality and our quality control, which has been key throughout the process. So looking for inconsistencies and ambiguities in the data. We meet weekly with our data producers, and we meet about monthly with our data consumers. And that's an ongoing process. That's been going on for since the beginning of the center. And we want our individual contributors, the data producers, to continue to work with their data, but their clean data. We want to add value to them. We do not want to get in their way to do their project-level studies. We have the data to answer program-level questions, and they can choose to use our tools or not. But again, that's a good working relationship. We understand their needs. We want to be able to leverage and customize, and I didn't go into a lot of detail on how much customization we did, but we basically took a tool that was designed strictly for environmental engineering, and we overloaded and redesigned the data schema significantly for EQUIS to be able to work for the environmental health project, where we have a much broader scope of data. This was one of the first projects that EarthSoft had worked with, and they've been a great partner. They basically have provided us with significant support, and they come to our retreats. So they're part of our team now, but we can leverage commercial tools that have been tested. EQUIS is used by hundreds and hundreds of EPA studies. This is a tool that's been tested time and time again. We do want to use state-of-the-art data analytics, and that's what we're moving to. The rate of innovation in the field, given what's happening with big data, I don't think I have to tell this community, or convince this community about that. So, and finally, I think it was brought up a couple of times, don't forget to include the computational resources needed. This is always an afterthought, particularly of whether you're, sometimes, as a computer engineer, it's one of my primary thoughts, but obviously I have also become much broader through working with the SRP program and Protect to understand a broader set of questions and needs throughout the center. With that, I'll finish up and just acknowledge our sponsors and see if anyone has any questions. Thank you.
Thanks, David. That was really great, and we do appreciate how you kind of went through and explained how you're integrating your data and what sorts of things that you had to consider, and got into the bit of the details. So that was really helpful. I've been remiss, and I've not been really engaging the people on the phone. So I will open it up to anybody on the phone who'd like to ask a question. first, and you can do that by pressing #6 to unmute your phone. So while you guys are unmuting your phones, I believe Jean's put a poll question up about if you what concerns you have about sharing your data. So if you can just take a moment to kind of let us know what you're thinking, that would be appreciated. And I'm just don't hear anybody speaking up on the phone line. So we did have a few questions that have come through the Q&A pod, and that was the question of chemical samples from your urine. The chemical samples from the urine samples that you get, do they underrepresent the in situ concentrations you might observe, say, through, you know, water samples due to breakdown?
I'm going to just put up my hand and say I'm a computer engineer. I could try to answer that, but I would actually Roger Deasy is here at Northeastern. He would be able to answer that probably much easier than myself. So I can... So I would defer to him.
Okay. Well, then what would you...
I'm always very clear that I know my expertise, and I try not to overstep that bound.
Very, very good. One question you might be maybe able to answer is how many principal component analyses did you get with the 130,000 features? Or how many PC did you get to the 130,000 features to? Did you get that?
I'm not sure I got the question.
It sounds like how many principal component
analysis were we able to get? So
yeah, 130,000 features too. So how many PCAs?
So we did two levels of data reduction first through peak picking and reduction, and then we got down to a small number. I'm trying to remember off the top of my head, we're not satisfied with that result yet, so we're still all I wanted to do was to show you the approach and not necessarily the results.
Okay.
So, I think we got down to three components when
okay.
we were done.
Yep, fair enough. Another question we had is, did you evaluate using EarthSoft's Edge in place of REDCap?
I'm familiar with Edge. We did look at Edge, but because we had started, Edge came out post the time we started using REDCap. We've been working with REDCap.
Okay. And the last question has to do with your last slide, where you talked about sort of lessons learned, and that was developing a comprehensive data dictionary. Before you begin. So did you feel like that was something you should, is that something that you can do, you have to have some data to start to do that, to know what sorts of data you need to provide a dictionary to? Or is that something you feel like you can start from the get-go? I'm thinking of your on-target analysis.
Right. No, obviously it's an ongoing process to build your data dictionary. What you need to do is whenever the data dictionary is added to, that it's a discussion across all of the projects. It just doesn't happen for one project. So everyone has to agree that that's the right name to call this field that two projects are going to be using. And that is always a very interesting discussion, I will tell you.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your presentation and additional questions that you'd like to ask. You can feel free to contact the presenters. Their contact information has been provided to you. So their email addresses are on the seminar homepage on CLUIN, which is linked to from the webinar webpage. And if you did submit an online questions, we did have a few that were submitted that we didn't get a chance to get to, we will just forward them on your behalf to the presenters. So again, I'd like to thank our presenters, Drs. Bill Sook, Alan Deary, Stephen DeMarco, and David Keeley for their time preparing for and sharing their presentations with us today. So just looking ahead to future webinars, we're in discussion with researchers in both academic and federal lab settings and we're planning for additional presentations from researchers, conducting exciting projects and producing large diverse data sets. And we hope to have them share their experiences and insights related to data handling and potential benefits of sharing data in future webinars. We will have other presenters discuss technical issues related to infrastructure needed to advance data sharing and integration. So, you know, as we heard here today, it's becoming increasingly clear that integration of data from multiple disciplines is critical to understand and address environmental public health issues. So stay tuned as we confirm the date and time. We're hoping this to be in September of this fall, and we'll email you with the details. That concludes the presentation from my side. Jean, I don't know if you had any additional housekeeping things that you wanted to bring up before we conclude?
Sure. Just I think you've already pointed out how the participants can share their feedback after today's live delivery, and that today's session was recorded, and you should automatically receive a link via email as soon as that free recording is available for replay and download.
Okay, great. Thanks so much, Jean, and thanks again to the presenters and for all of you for sticking with us for 2 hours on this exciting topic. And we hope you'll join us in September as we continue our conversation. Have a great day, everybody.
Thank you.